Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 12th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Bradley Hansen. Today's session is numbered 99-5 and is titled Lutheran Spirituality, God's Presence in Physical Symbols. Let's listen in.
Brad Hansen. And I'm teaching a series on Lutheran spirituality. It started last week, and it's continuing this week. These presentations are based upon a book that I've just sent in mid-June to the publisher, and that'll the final version of it. And then that will be the book will actually come out, they say, in January. In any case, what I'm going to do today will be, for those of you who were there early on last week, but that's very few, there'll be some repetition here, because what I want to do is kind of go back and set the context for talking about Lutheran spirituality. Can you hear me all right? Okay. There's been tremendous interest in spirituality in the last 25 years. That word itself has become very popular. Lots of sessions, lots of books that are published on spirituality. And one of my questions is, why is that? What is there about the culture, the context in which we live, in which that kind of interest has come forward and that interest has been pinned on that word? Well, maybe what I'll do is just sketch a few characteristics of what I see as the some major features of our cultural context today. One of those features is greater social pluralism. By that I mean we've got lots of people who have different convictions and often different religious views living close together. I mean, it used to be that, you know, the Muslims were down in the Middle East and over in Indonesia and a few places like that, but they weren't necessarily in Seattle or Denver or, you know, living next door. And you could just multiply that on down the line, so that we've got much greater social pluralism. Now, I think that's simply a fact of life. What that does, though, that has a profound effect upon us, whether we acknowledge it or not, that it has a profound effect upon people, because a good deal of what we believe to be true and to be good depends upon having social support, having other people who confirm those beliefs. And so in the past, quite often, people lived in much more enclosed communities where there was lots of support for certain belief system. Well, when you mix people up and you have lots of different people representing different belief systems, then there's much more uncertainty, you see, about what is true and what is good. Now, that gives rise also, then, to greater individual choice, greater emphasis on individual choice in matters of faith. Now, that's not because I think people today are braver than previous generation. I think it's simply the result of this first factor, the greater social pluralism. It forces, particularly those of us who are older, we lived through a different time. We grew up in a different time. But for people that are young today, I mean, it's a different world for them. And their sense of choice, of options, not only, you know, about what kind of car to buy, but options about religious views and how you're going to live your life. That's a whole range of options that are available to them. And what that has done is also that there has created more elective ties to religious institutions. Well, probably not only religious institutions, but probably every institution. But what we're talking about is religious institutions. In other words, for most of us, those of us who got gray hair, when we grew up, the chances are that we, at least in our younger years, continued in the church tradition that we had been raised in. That was the pattern. People tended to stay in the same church tradition that they had been raised in. But by, you know, the mid-80s already, what's called switching, you know, moving from one denomination to another, already there were about a little more than a third, about 38% of people at that point had already been involved in at least one denominational switch. And today, I think if you took a poll, I think it would be considerably higher than that. So the ties to institutions then, religious institutions in this case, have, in some cases, I describe, they aren't necessarily looser, but they are the result of election choice in a way that perhaps was less so for some previous generations. And so I think you can sort of see that there's perhaps a kind of spectrum of ways that people relate to religious institutions. And I would chart it out something like this, that you could talk about loyal members. These are people who, you know, they'll have a gripe here or there about their church or denomination, but they're kind of really in there, very supportive, committed to it. But secondly, you can talk, there's people who are loving critics. That they are in a church, but they're in a denomination, but they have some rather strong objections to some of the things going on there, but by golly, they're still going to be. You know, this, like, for instance, this is the one of the most common examples of this would be Roman Catholics, a number of whom would have very deep dissatisfaction with the patriarchy and the hierarchy of Roman Catholic Church, and yet they say, you know, I'm going to still be Roman Catholic. You can find this with Lutherans as well. You can find Lutherans who are, let's say, very touched by evangelicalism. And now there's some links there you can establish with the Lutheran tradition, but they are much more kind of outgoing, wanting to convey their faith, to tell others about their faith, and that's something that Lutherans are, for the most part, have not been good about. Now, an evangelical Lutheran will kind of feel, you know, gee, I'd just like to kick those other Lutherans in my congregation or my denomination, kind of get them moving. But rather than joining a Baptist church, you know, that person still stays a Lutheran, you see. And that's what I mean by a kind of loving critic. But then, thirdly, you could talk about people who are, I call them spiritual shoppers. Who, at least at this point in their life, are kind of not happy anywhere. They haven't identified with any denomination. And at this point in their life, they're kind of looking around. And probably all of us do that to some extent. If we happen to move from one community to another, we do a little shopping, church shopping, see? Well, but there, you know, there are folks who maybe remain spiritual shoppers for a longer period of time. And then we could talk about independent seekers. That's not very readable, is it? Independent seekers. Independent. That is to say, what I want to suggest by that term is that persons who are do not really gear into any institution. They may, in a very sustained way, but at least at this point in their life, are they may drift in, drift out. They may have kind of affiliate in some sense, participate in it in a church organization or an institution like Holden. You see, you can kind of participate in Holden, but it doesn't kind of tie you to any thing in a long range way necessarily. So there are a number of folks that are independent seekers, I think, as well. Now, it's in this cultural context, I think, greater pluralism and more emphasis upon personal choice, and then the kind of more elective ties to religious institutions, that this phenomenon of the interest in in spirituality has arisen. And I think it's because of this kind of context, this cultural context, the emphasis upon personal choice, that people are seeking, I think. For instance, you'll find people, some people will say, particularly people off at this end of the spectrum will say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. You may have heard that. I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. Now, for them, religious or religion is a negative term. It implies some sort of kind of dead institution that is merely external, but there isn't really any life in it, you see. So religion for that person is kind of negative. Spirituality or spiritual is good, it's positive. It has to do with what is mine, what is my own religious experience. Well, but even people, I think, that who do participate in an ongoing way in religious institutions, many still are also reading books about spirituality and going to workshops on spirituality. And what I think they're seeking for in many ways is to have a kind of more personal experience, a kind of deeper, growing experience of their tradition. So whether or not one is a kind of independent seeker or a loyal member, I think there could be still a kind of interest in spirituality, and it's this emphasis, I think, upon a personal faith, one that I actually experience. Now, what has happened, I think, in this, now I'll make the transition to Lutheran spirituality, okay? Why talk about Lutheran spirituality? In the last 30 years, since the 60s, really, I think there has been a lot of these forces have been very strong, and there's been a lot of seeking going on. And one important sociologist of religion has said that the result of that has often been that dabbling, not going very deep, but kind of sampling a little bit of this or that, but not really going very deep. And what he's suggesting is at this point in our history that he's suggesting that we need what he calls a spirituality of practice, by which, in that term for the author here is Robert Wuthnow, a sociologist at Princeton University. Wuthnow suggests that what is needed is a spirituality of practice, and by that he means having some set of practices that one finds fruitful for growth and, of faith and expression of faith, but that those practices are connected with a tradition and with a community where you have people who are knowledgeable in that tradition and how these various practices may be carried out and their significance and their meaning within that tradition. Well, what I'm suggesting here is that I think this is a good time to be talking and looking at Lutheran spirituality as one of those options that is there. That I think it is a rich tradition. It's not the only tradition. It's not necessarily the best tradition. But it is a very rich tradition, I think, with its own strengths and weaknesses. And so I'm not trying to make a case that this is this is the best spirituality. I think when we think in terms of spirituality, again, there's a sense of diversity, appreciation of diversity. And I think Lutheran spirituality is kind of a tradition which has some richness and depth to it and has some real strengths to offer the larger church in the world. So that's why I'm doing this session or these series of sessions on Lutheran spirituality. And what I've done is to identify seven characteristics of Lutheran spirituality. And there you see them all kind of laid out. And I'll just quickly look at some of these. The first one we dealt with was that the Lutheran tradition has a kind of serious read or interpretation of the human condition. It's not the only tradition that has that serious read, but it certainly is one that does. Secondly here, this point two, for those of you who have kind of theological training, this is justification by grace through faith, but it's not, I'm trying to get beyond a doctrine, you see. What does the doctrine seek to have us, how does it seek to inform our life? And what kind of relationship does it seek to foster with God? And it seems to me that what justification means, what it seeks to foster, is a relationship of trust in God, a trust that God's merciful grace undergirds all of life. It's not just a matter of forgiveness of sins. It is that, but it is more than that. I treated that last week. Reliance on the Word of God and Scripture proclamation and music as the primary source of spiritual nurture. In Christian traditions, nearly all Christian traditions say the primary means, the main means through which we have access to the gospel, the love of God as known in Jesus Christ, are through word and sacrament. Nearly all Christian traditions affirm that. But they differ on which of those is primary. Here's a Protestant traditions, for example, here's a little sketch here, outline of church traditions, and Roman Catholic and Orthodox traditions, particularly Roman Catholic, I think, is primarily a sacramental tradition. Sacraments are the primary means of grace. Every Mass, every Sunday, well, even daily Mass, everyone is a Eucharist. And the homily or the sermon, it tends to be somewhat short. And in weekday Masses, it may be just a kind of few comments made by the priest who has done a little reflection on the daily text, you know, just kind of off the top of the head. In the Protestant traditions here, and I haven't got all the Protestant bodies here, but I've got, I think, kind of the main the groupings. For all of these, word is the primary means in various degrees. So it's that word of God is expressed in words that is the primary means. And so, if you go into a Protestant church, and this would be true in Lutheran churches as well, right? That you probably don't have communion every Sunday. And that's true in most Lutheran churches yet today. Some are there, some are moving in that direction. But there will be an emphasis upon preaching, certainly. And you'll have a more substantial, longer sermon than you would customarily get in a Roman Catholic church, you see. So, word is primary there, I think. And yet, for the Lutheran tradition, I think the next characteristic that I identify about Lutheran spirituality is that it does have a fairly strong emphasis upon sacraments as a means of grace. stronger on the whole than traditions up further here this way, you see. So that sacraments are of greater significance, probably the Eucharist is celebrated more frequently. Okay, so the characteristic that we're talking about today then is about of Lutheran spirituality is this fourth one, confidence that God's grace is present in baptism and Lord's Supper and may also work through other physical symbols. This one right here, okay? And maybe, let me just pause and see if there's any questions on any of that sort of general background so far. Any comments or questions about it? So, sacraments and other God's grace being present through the Lord's Supper and baptism and also may work through other physical symbols. As you probably know, Lutherans recognize two sacraments, baptism and the Lord's Supper. There was a question about a third. That was confession and absolution. If you look at some of the early treatises of Luther, he counts that as a sacrament. But he has also some questions about it. And he, the question was, he says, well, there doesn't seem to be a physical symbol associated with confession and absolution. Well, you're supposed to have laying on of hands with absolution, but then laying on of hands is done with other things as well, and so there doesn't seem to be a distinctive physical gesture or symbol associated with it. And so what happens is that confession and absolution was not kind of, it was sort of on a borderline. And so we tended not to call it a sacrament, and yet, Luther and in Lutheran confessions, it's been emphasized that this should continue. It is very important. Now, we'll come back to that a little bit to talk about that. But just right now, to mention that there are two certain sacraments, and there's some, you have this kind of borderline third ritual of confession absolution. In the Lutheran tradition. And that's in common with most other Protestant traditions. The number of sacraments, actually, is an issue that is hard to settle. If you go to the New Testament, that isn't there. There's no way to tell how many sacraments there are. The term sacrament doesn't even occur. You have the term mystery that's used in the Orthodox tradition. But even there, it's kind of used in a somewhat different sense, and it's never defined. And in fact, in the early church, the first several centuries, the whole number of sacraments was indefinite. Like St. Augustine, around 400, considered making the sign of the cross. Making the sign of the cross a sacrament. Why? Well, it's a visible sign of an invisible grace. That's how he's understood a sacrament. A visible sign of an invisible grace. And it's only in the Middle Ages then, around, you start getting it being narrowed down so it's a defined number. And so around 1200 and thereafter, you have, in the Roman Catholic tradition, you have it being kind of settled officially from 1200 on roughly that there are seven sacraments. Well, then Luther comes along and the Protestants, and Luther says, well, he has a little different definition of a sacrament. And he says it has to have a physical sign, but it has to be something also which is explicitly, there's an explicit promise and command from Jesus. He says, well, where do you have an explicit promise and command from Jesus about marriage as a sacrament, you see? So this is why the whole question about the number of sacraments was something that has been a matter of debate, and it's something that's it all depends on what you define as a sacrament. Okay. Well, the in this what I should talk about further is the relationship between sacraments and sacramentality. The point here is that the more emphasis that is given to sacraments, it seems to me, the greater emphasis there is upon physical symbols generally. And that this emphasis upon physical symbols as means through which God speaks to us or conveys a message to us, that is what is called often sacramentality. All right? Now, if you look at these various church traditions again, you'll see that there are different degrees of sacramentality. And I think there's a correlation here between the prominence of physical symbols generally and the prominence given to those specific rites called sacraments. For example, go into an Orthodox church. How many of you ever been in an Orthodox church? Lots of symbols, right? You got candles, you got icons, your nose, there's your fragrant incense often. There's a lot of physical symbols there. Now, what's the, again, there's this tremendous emphasis upon the Eucharist. This frequent Eucharist, even every Sunday would be a Eucharist. Also, there's a certain understanding of the Eucharist. It is what you might call a realistic understanding. Orthodox tradition is very close to the Roman Catholic tradition in saying something like transubstantiation occurs here. In other words, Christ is really present somehow in this Eucharist. All right? So you have frequent use of the Eucharist, a very kind of emphasis, a certain understanding of Christ's presence there, that this presence is somehow real in this bread and wine and throughout the action of the Eucharist. Now, what I'm saying is that I think there's a connection here between that way of practicing the Eucharist and the prominence of physical symbols. Let's go into, let's say, imagine going into a Baptist church. And you probably would find, what about the Eucharist? It'll vary, of course. It may be only four or five times a year, quarterly, and then around in Holy Week. Or it may be monthly. But probably that's, you know, about as often as it'll get. What is the understanding of Christ's presence here? It is what's often called the memorial view. That it is the sacrament, the Eucharist is a means by which we recall, we are reminded of Christ and what Christ did. Okay, it's a kind of more cerebral. It's a view of the understanding of Christ's presence which is more rational to us in our culture. But it is a kind of more cerebral understanding. And then if you look around at the church sanctuary, how many physical symbols do you have? Probably not very many. Probably very plain, very simple. Now, it seems to me there's a connection here between practice, emphasis, the promise given to the sacraments, and I've been using the Eucharist as the example here, and physical symbols generally. All right. Now, how about the Lutherans in this regard? Well, we're sort of in the middle. like the Anglicans are too. That even though we give our first emphasis, our primary emphasis upon words, sacraments are really quite important to us. There's considerable emphasis. There is at least the official teaching is one of a real presence, that somehow Christ is really present here. And you go into, you know, Lutheran churches, and on the whole, it's going to have more physical symbols than, say, the Baptist church, but perhaps on average less than most Roman Catholic or Orthodox churches, you see. We're kind of an in-between tradition in that respect. And I'm not saying that one is necessarily better than the other. It's just that I'm trying to point out some connections here, I think. Now, what's happening in Lutheran circles in regard to sacraments? I think there's been an increased emphasis upon sacraments and how they connect with our lives in the last 25 years or so. First of all, with baptism, there's been a renewed emphasis upon what was Luther's teaching, that baptism is not just something that took place long ago in our life, but baptism should be something which we daily remember. That there is a daily dying of the old self and a rising of the new self that trusts in God. See, that daily dying, daily rising. That Luther said this should be something that we think about, recall every day, because we kind of turn away from our old ways and turn anew to Christ. Now, it is though, I think that's an important emphasis upon baptism. However, it seems to me that in many cases at least, this is taught in Lutheran circles still, but it's still a matter of mainly mentally remembering. But in some churches, and you see it here in the VC, that when you walk in, there's the book, a rack of books there. What is the next thing you encounter as you walk into the VC? The baptismal font in which you can, it's placed there to encourage people to dip their hand in the water and make the sign of the cross. And why do you do that? What's the purpose?
Remember your baptism.
Remember your baptism, yeah. What I like to do is when I walk into church, I like to do that, and it reminds and to recall particularly of God's mercy and acceptance of me. And then when I walk out of church, I like to do it again, and this time to emphasize more in my thoughts about God's continuing renewing life, you know, and power in my life. It's a little different emphasis each time. But yes, it is. It's a matter of remembering our baptism. Or how many of you come from churches where you have, say, around the Easter, with the Easter Vigil, you'll have a sprinkling of water, you see? Again, see, the use, not only thinking it with our minds, but using tangible things that touch us, actual water. It's not just words any longer, but it's also other physical symbols. The two together are more powerful, perhaps, and can communicate in our lives in richer and deeper ways. Secondly, I think there's been an increased emphasis upon baptism. Secondly, an increased emphasis upon the Eucharist, that I think we've been moving towards more frequent Eucharist. If you kind of plotted churches, Lutheran churches, over the last 30 years, I think you'd see that on the whole they've been moving toward more frequent Eucharist. And I think we'll find that probably another couple decades in probably the majority of Lutheran churches will be having weekly communion. Also with confession and absolution. Now, Do we do confession and absolution?
In the liturgy, yeah.
It's always a court. We do it as a corporate thing, don't we? A corporate confession, a corporate absolution. Now, what we have almost lost was private confession and absolution. Now, it's interesting to see that for about 200 years after the Reformation, private confession and absolution was still practiced among many Lutherans. I mean, there's some references in some writings of 1675 that indicate that private confession and absolution was still going on. But what we're now, I think there's getting to be a little more attention to that once again. And so that, for instance, in the Lutheran Book of Worship or Lutheran Worship, the Missouri Synod book, that they both have rites of private confession and absolution. How about what happens on Maundy Thursday in your church?
Ashes.
Well, that's an Ash Wednesday, yes. But pardon? Okay, you have washing of the feet. Do any of you come from churches in our church anyway, the congregation I've been involved in, on Maundy Thursday, we have a confession of sin that is corporate, but then we also go and we kneel, and the pastor comes and lays hands on our head and pronounces absolution individually. Now, that's a kind of hybrid there, you see, corporate confession. But I think there's getting to be a little bit more emphasis on the private confession and absolution as well. Well, I think the overall effect of these things is going to be that perhaps we will have a richer appreciation of physical symbols generally. Well, I'll pause there to see if there's some comments or questions. I have a little exercise for you to do, a little reflection. But if you have some comments or questions about anything that I've said so far, then we can.
Don't be afraid.
Question.
Yes.
To what extent do you think that the symbolism of the Lutheran Church is an inhibitor to the seeker who does not come from a Lutheran background? Let's say the has never been in a church.
Yes.
Decides
yes.
They want to start their kid in Sunday school to mm-hmm. raise them up morally. Mm-hmm. Come to a Lutheran church and experience this symbolism that they don't understand. What impact does that have?
Any thoughts on that? Did you hear the question? Yes.
Yeah, I think it depends on how they approach symbol. I've always considered whether it's sacramental or not, or what do you understand the official theology behind that symbolism, and symbols carry meanings that can't be carried in words. And if the seeker apprehends some other meaning behind the symbol, it would make it easy, but I concur that certain aspects of the symbolism may be the same thing you referred to as somebody whom religion is a pejorative term. Mm-hmm. It really depends on the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the next generation that has had no background, this is the first time where they have no connection to parents that have even been in worship, then they don't have a connection to that symbol at all. And it really has an impact or is possibly going to change. I mean, I don't know how that's going to impact the church.
So
we have 80% of the new people coming in are ex-folk.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But are you saying that they can't gear into symbols, or?
Yeah, I'm saying they are sort of turned off by symbols.
Okay.
I don't think we should have to give up our symbolism. We need to teach these people more. We see this in fraternal organizations and in all of our churches. And I don't think we should have to give up our precious symbols that we have grown up with and, feel deeply about to accommodate the younger people. Maybe we need to do more teaching to give them a better, deeper understanding, because I think it deepens our religion.
Well, I think along with that, our church has new membership classes that are maybe, an 8-week thing, and it just explains a about those in religion and symbols and to help people be informed and comfortable in the church.
But you have to be able to be willing to, you have to get to a certain point that you're willing to go to the class, yes.
I think they create insiders and outsiders.
Symbols do.
Our whatever form we use that's not communicated. And I think this is the crisis of all of our regular denominational churches today, is making that bridge, wanting to hold on to what's important to those of us over 50 while we're finding ways to communicate to people who don't have that tradition.
Okay, yes.
When people are outside, they don't want to come back.
Yeah, yes.
Sir, I was a Catholic child, I was never a Catholic adult.
Uh-huh.
Your remark about, you know, the signs of the cross on entering the church.
Yes.
Never, ever was I told as a child, to my knowledge, that this symbolized baptism in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I don't know whether I was actually told this or not, but this is the first time it's ever occurred to me, and I think I'm going to return to it if I can.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking as a current Catholic, I agree. I don't recall ever being told that. There's a certain level of instruction which has to happen with any symbol. We all have symbols. I have several pancakes every Sunday. For me, there's a certain symbolism in that we grew up in. I think people understand symbols very well. It's a matter of perhaps translating the symbol like you described, so that you can take on the symbol you learned way back when.
Yeah, well, the seven stations of the cross, for example, is something that I know is entirely symbolic in my view, even then it was. But this never occurred to me.
You wanted to say?
I think that's the gift of symbols, that they can be open-ended and they're multiversed and there's lots of room. I think what we need to do as a church, though, is be receptive to the reinterpretation of some of those symbols and some of the fresh things. In my confirmation class, all of a sudden we've got this crop of kids who were just baptized like in the fifth and sixth grade, so they never went to Sunday school. And this last year, and this is more iconography than symbolism, but we did a passion quilt, and we had to illustrate the different parts of the passion story. And a couple of the kids chose the Garden of Gethsemane. And in my mind, I mean, it's always attached to that picture of Jesus praying, on the rock, and it's got certain colors. And I was so startled to find the children coming up with this picture of flowers. Some had carrots planted in the garden. Jesus was in bell bottoms and had this long hair. And, you know, it was like a sunny day in the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus was there praying. And he was praying in the Arise position, which is the position these children have seen me pray. And it really opened my eyes to the ways that those symbols can be reinterpreted. But as a church, we're going to need to be open, you know, and I'm not going to have to sit down and say, no, Jesus has to be at the rock and it has to be dark.
Yes.
I was bringing up more of a question to you. You've given us the background, but where do you see it kind of going now? Have you studied the kind of, like, the younger generation and what they're seeing, what they're interpreting from us, you know?
Well, let me just maybe not speak so directly to that, but kind of speak to the original question some. Because I think it is an important question. The churches up here, for instance, the free churches particularly, were formed in many ways by revivalism. In the 19th century and continues on into this century. And revivalism has been a way of seeking to reach the unchurched. And so that's been the real strength, I think, of those traditions. And they have done it with very little, a kind of squeezing down, you might say, of the symbolism. Things are kind of, I taught a class, last January, and one of the students, I had them visit different churches, and she went to an evangelical church that's in that kind of Baptist tradition, and she was a Roman Catholic, and her comment after, she kind of appreciated it in some ways, but she says, everything was was so kind of straightforward. It was all very understandable. Nothing kind of mysterious about it. And I think that, see, now that has a certain appeal. It has a certain draw. But maybe you're kind of flattening down things as well. You're because, goodness sakes, we're talking about God. How can you talk about God in straightforward stuff? I mean, you got to use symbols, don't you? Man alive. But no passion here, you know. Maybe just another little piece with that. One of the other traditions that has been growing in America is the Roman Catholic tradition. By golly, you go in here and you get the Mass, there is a lot of symbolism there. And it's not just that they're all growing up Catholics, there's a lot of folks that are becoming, the Catholic Church is growing. Which is where, something that the Lutheran Church in America, we've been kind of slipping very slightly for the last 25 to 30 years. On the one hand, it's kind of a mixed message. On the one hand, you see the some churches in the more revivalist tradition, yes, they do have a way of kind of reaching some of those totally unchurched people. That seems to work for some folks. On the other hand, though, by golly, the Roman Catholics seem to be doing it as well. And so I don't know if there's a kind of clear message here to say, well, if you want to reach the unchurched, then you should kind of avoid symbols because people won't understand them.
Just a question. I guess what I'm wondering about as we've been going through even the lecture today and are thinking about it is that in some ways we, in the Protestant tradition, Lutherans included, are very, very rational and very reasonable. Everything is quite cerebral, if I can say it that way. My sense about people who are seeking for spirituality is that they're not looking in that place. We have always been pretty good at that. I don't think they're looking there. I think they're looking for the mystery. They're looking for the emotive. They're looking for other things that will touch them. In my new member classes, I haven't found it to be particularly helpful to people to give them the three meanings of communion. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem to be what they're interested in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real challenge. I think symbols can get in touch with the mystery, and I think we're on the right track there. But I think we are so cerebral, and not sure that that's speaking very well to those who are searching right now.
Yeah, okay. In fact, in the whole business about explaining the symbols, you see, I mean, that's the kind of, one of the dangers there is the kind of rationalistic reduction, you see. Symbols resist that. Always, you can never really capture all that good symbols have and can communicate. And people have to kind of grow into them somewhat. But some explaining, I think, probably is helpful. Like the thing about the cross, and baptism. Yes.
There is another Catholic symbol that I didn't know exactly what it meant. And that was genuflection before I got into the aisle to sit down. I knew that meant obeisance to God, something I couldn't understand.
Yeah,
I guess that's what it meant. I can't imagine meaning anything else. Yeah.
Just think of what, for example, in many Lutheran churches, of course we've changed that now because of the way we administer communion quite often, but in many Lutheran churches it's still the case that people kneel for communion. And that's quite often, in many churches, Lutheran churches, it's the only time that people kneel in the service. Now, why? You see, the bodily act is a testimony to that real presence, because this is a time for special reverence here, it seems to me.
A lot of Lutheran churches are having the kneeling benches in there. And
yes.
They also kneel, and they also have the laying out of hands in communion.
Right.
Right. Where they'll have two lines,
and
you can choose which one you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, more attention to kind of the physical symbols. Do you think that something like those kinds of symbols are put off, that put off people who haven't had church backgrounds?
I've seen those churches growing.
Pardon? You've seen those churches?
Huge congregations. Because it gives people the choice for that time, how they feel and how they want to receive it.
Okay.
To follow up on that, it seems to me that the unchurched will often interact with the church during weddings and funerals.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that that's a time when they want symbolism, or perhaps that's a Western cultural phenomenon, that they associate weddings with somehow a spiritual experience, and the same with funerals.
Mm-hmm.
And so they seek that understanding of either the blessings or the symbolisms that they want to have as part of their grief in funerals or as part of their joy in weddings.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, it appears to me they're much more interested in Sunday morning baseball than they are in religious symbolism in terms of how they spend their time.
Sure. Yes.
I think we should be instructed on how to cross ourselves. I sat next to the font last night, and I almost chuckled several times of the different procedures of crossing yourself. It was really funny. I mean, as Lutherans, I think we're really afraid to get our hands out there, you know, and do it. It was just almost comical. Is it also proper to just cross the forehead at that time?
Well, I mean, what is proper?
Yeah.
What is proper? That's where I think you get too tidy about some of these things, and that can turn people off. You know, there's a kind of right way to do it.
I'm Presbyterian. I'm totally turned off by that kind of commentary. You know, that if I may do it wrong, then I don't want to be there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, any other thoughts? Well, I think that Lutheranism as Lutheran spiritual, I mean, you can't be all things to all people. All right? And the Lutheran tradition seems to be this kind of mediating tradition that participates in many of the things of Protestantism generally, and yet it has a lot of commonalities with the Roman Catholic and Orthodox tradition. Furthermore, we should say this, that there isn't just one kind of Lutheran spirituality. Lutheranism, just like any other of these traditions, is a family. And family members are not all identical twins. Family members resemble one another, and they have a common heritage, but they're not identical. And so it is, I think, that within the Lutheran spirituality, we're really talking about a family of spiritualities in which there's considerable diversity. I mean, you get some Lutherans that are very much, very evangelical. They want to get out there and reach people, kind of bring them to the Lord. You get other Lutherans who are much more kind of social action oriented, et cetera, you see. And plus then you add in various ethnic traditions and how that feeds into the mix. Well, you get considerable diversity then. But I think what kind of keeps us together as Lutherans as a tradition is that sort of that common heritage and paying attention to that heritage and dialoguing with it. Not that we do everything the same way. So I think there's room in our tradition. And that's one of the things I'll be talking about one of the other later sessions, is that ours is a tradition where there are some things that are really core that there's a profound commitment to. Like, you know, the gospel of Jesus Christ, a Christ-centeredness. On the other hand, there's a whole lot of things that are, we consider what we call adiaphora, kind of, you know, they're not essential. And so there can be lots of variations, and they're kind of freedom of being able to have diversity in a variety of practices. both. And so I think that's where you can find Lutheran churches that can be considerably different. Some that perhaps are much more symbolic, some that are much less symbolic in how they do worship in their sanctuary. And there still can be Lutheran, I think. So I think there's room there for some range. There isn't just kind of one right way to do it. I was going to ask you to do a little reflection thing. And unless somebody has a burning question, I'll ask you to do that now. But if somebody's got a real hot question. Okay. I was just going to ask you to reflect for yourself. What is the most meaningful physical symbol for you? Physical symbol in the sense of God's kind of presence being communicated or conveyed through that physical symbol. Now, it may be or may not be a sacrament. It may be some other physical symbol. But just to reflect, and maybe you can't come up with just the one that's the cow. Maybe there's a couple. But just to think, what is that physical symbol, or perhaps several of them, that really speak to me, really connect me with God? God somehow makes use of that symbol to communicate with me. Maybe just spend a minute or so reflecting on that. Well, if we had a little more time, I would ask you to kind of share in small groups so you could each get a word in there to kind of share what and listen to someone else. But anybody would like to share as to to identify a physical symbol that particularly speaks to them? Yes.
For me, it's the presence of the cross.
The presence of the cross. Uh-huh. Okay.
Not a crucifix necessarily, just the presence of the cross. Then I know it's a Christian
symbol. Uh-huh. Yeah, and is that, so then do you, for instance, do you usually wear a cross yourself? Or?
No, I've never worn a cross as jewelry, and I'm not sure why, but when I see that, it somehow makes me uncomfortable, but in the church, it makes me feel like the church is going to be.
Okay.
Because I've been in churches where it's not there, and it's just like something is missing.
Yeah, yeah.
I have been in churches where I don't see it, and I'm looking for it. Isn't there a cross in the windows?
Yes, on the cross. The cross and stained glass window is part of the altar.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The remembrance, and then the stained glass window that goes on to eternity.
Yeah.
Your soul reminds us.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, so you can kind of through, you kind of go beyond. Yeah, well, that's interesting, yeah. Could you hear that? Okay. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes.
For me, it's kneeling in prayer, although I was brought up in a Lutheran church, although the old Huggies in it, which is very non-liturgical, but at home, bedtime prayers as a child, I always knelt. And even though I didn't continue that, and I don't routinely now, but when there's some real special thing or need that I have, I feel I get down on my knees and pray it's a meaningful thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
Well, I live in a dominantly non-Christian community. And I was thinking that the fish symbol on the bumper of a car, because I live in a community where there are more Darwin symbols on the bumpers of cars. And that tells me that the owner of this car is out there and is telling the world that they believe in Jesus.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, besides the presence, the altar, just a reminder that Christ is our altar. Uh-huh. So it's hard for me not to see an altar when I'm going.
Is there a particular author or alter that draws you, or is it, isn't that necessary? Okay. Well, maybe I think it's quarter two, so we should we'll probably have to quit. Our time is up. But thank you very much. Good discussion. Thank you.